You're with Liam Del Calm and Brendan Nell on the To The Last Drop podcast.
Welcome back. It's To The Last Drop. I'm Brendan Nell.
And I'm Liam Del Calm.
And yes, we're back again. We're into the playoff rounds. We're starting to go tail down to the end of the season. We're already getting to those, as what they call the business end. I hate that sort of that whole way of looking at things where people say it's the business end of the season. But we are on that point. There's 16 became eight, eight teams, five nations represented. And for the first time, one quarterfinalist from every one of the five nations. So Wales and Scotland, who've missed out in the past, have both got a quarterfinalist, seventh and eighth on the log, but still they're in the quarterfinals. So they'll give them some interest. And two South African teams. We were hoping for three, but two South African teams. Liam, an interesting weekend. We had to wait till the last kick of the last match to know who the eight finalists, quarterfinalists were.
Yeah, and I think that's great for the competition. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, South African fans will be a little bit saddened that the Lions didn't make it. But overall, I would imagine that with all those teams from different territories qualifying, it only sort of amplifies the interest in the competition. So great for the URC, not so good for the Lions, but we'll touch on that a little bit later.
Yeah, let's begin with the two teams that did make it. There was an epic clash in Durban. The Bulls went down there. A tough game for them, as we said last week. Very, very tricky for them. The Sharks had nothing to lose, and the Bulls had everything to lose in that game. But they weren't at their best. They broke the try scoring record for URC in that game. Leinster's try scoring record from last season. The competition is only three seasons old, so I suppose you have to look at it in perspective. But still, they went out, they needed four tries, they got them. It wasn't pretty. Three more tries. But in the end, they almost had sense of relief for the Bulls and ended up second on the log. And I think if you look back now, that loss to Munster was probably the difference why they didn't end top.
Yeah, in the end it was. I thought a very business-like performance from the Bulls. Did what they had to do. There was a little patch in the game where they hit a bit of a wall in the second half, but they corrected that, scored another maul try towards the end to just sort of reaffirm their dominance. A thoroughly professional performance, I thought. As for the Sharks, we didn't quite know what to expect from them in that game, given what happened the week before. The high of winning the Challenge Cup had to obviously make a few changes for the Bulls game. And while they were very spirited, I don't think anybody realistically expected them to turn the balls over.
Yeah, and I think the surprising thing for me, but I mean, you know, often these little subplots in games, the front rows, the Bulls definitely struck a blow there. The World Cup winning front row are what conceded five penalties in the game, which is surprising, I think, to a lot of us. But and Bongi and Mbonambi's lineout throws were whether it was him or whether it was the locks, or you know, sometimes it's a combination of both. They were pretty poor, and that sort of helped the Bulls in the set pieces. So whether that was just a sort of a hangover from the week before, whether it was just a bad game for those guys, or which I'm sure they're entitled to, or whether it was just that the fact that Eben Etzebeth wasn't there, and maybe the composition of Type 5 was a bit different to what they used to. Who knows? But it certainly sort of upped the Bulls' front row's sort of claims for Springbok selection. And when you go do that sort of demolition job against a World Cup winning front row, that's got to count for something.
I left that game with that impression as well, that those guys have certainly made a statement. Look, nobody's suggesting for one moment that suddenly, you know, the Sharks front row, as they started last week, shouldn't be in the Springbok team. Of course they should. But I think if anything was proved last week, is that our front row, so I think it's front row resources, I think it's more than decent. I think it's formidable.
Yeah, I mean, if you just think of what the Sharks have, and then you think of the likes of Trevor Niakani, Thomas Du Toit, who's tearing it up at Bath, who was in the team of the season, those Bulls props, Nathan Fouchier doing pretty well. There's lots of talent coming through. And I suppose the big thing is, who do you pick?
Yeah, I suppose the Wales game does give the coaches the opportunity to cast the net a little bit wider. And then come Ireland 2 weeks later, we should see something that resembles what we saw in the World Cup final last year, because it will be all hands on deck. An absolute monster series in so many ways. So, thankfully we don't select the team, Brendan.
Yeah, thankfully we don't. I must admit, I think probably for that Ireland test, I can't see them deviating too much, barring injuries, of course. But the Wales test will certainly give us an idea of what the future plans for the Springbok team are, and hopefully we'll see a couple. Of course, I mean, I say that with an asterisk, because if the Bulls or Stormers are in a final that weekend, then it's going to be tough, because you're not going to have those players available. But I mean, we're talking about a handful of players on each side. So we'll get a good indication of where we're going with the Springbok team for the next couple of years. And I think the Boks have been rather consistent in terms of that, in their selections and in bringing in young players as well. They've got now a full cycle, hopefully, unless some sort of disaster hits us again, like a pandemic or something, to blood those players. So I'm sure they've got plans, and I'm sure we'll see them pretty soon.
No, absolutely. The Wales test for me is going to be an interesting one, because it does give us that opportunity to sort of glance into the future. We are, what have we now, 3 years away from the next World Cup, and it'll be very interesting to see how many, if you look back, once you get to that World Cup, to look back at the Wales game that's going to be played in London, how many of those younger players would have walked the journey, or walked the walk with the Boks.
It's a strange test, because it's obviously there to bring in a bit of revenue. There's no other reason why we'd be playing at Twickenham. I mean, that's obviously one of the reasons. Let's be extremely honest about it. But it does serve the purpose that the Boks, the majority of the Boks squad, barring those involved maybe in cup competitions, we'll be together for a couple of weeks before that Ireland test. And yeah, the way Rule 9 of World Rugby works, you can only get your players 5 days before or 6 days before a test. So that serves that purpose, to get the majority, well, as many as you can, together and to start working on those Ireland tests. So I suppose in that way, whatever happens in Wales, and I mean, we'll focus a bit more on Wales closer to the time, but it seems like they've picked a very young squad as well. Lots of strange unknown names, or names that we're not used to, but it's going to be an interesting test, I think, more from a Springbok viewpoint, because I think it'll tell us a lot about the future. So,
yeah, and I think the other point that's worth making is that there are a couple of new coaches in that Springbok setup. So there will be, that initial period of people have to familiarize themselves with a new environment. And I suppose the reset button would have to be pressed this season. So, those are things that the Boks management would have to take on board.
Yeah, well, let's turn to the other game, the earlier game, the very strange 1:45 kickoff in Cape Town. The Lions went up against the Stormers. And, well, where do we start? I think the first talk about the Stormers, because I think we could do a whole podcast on the Lions if we had to. I thought the Stormers were nothing really on the game. The Stormers were nothing on that game. I think what impressed me was the fact that they scored when it mattered. They won the game, first of all, when there was nothing in it for them. And their defense in that second half, when they were under the pump a bit, certainly showed the character of the team. So while they're not the Stormers of 2 years ago, and they've still got maybe one or two flaws, they are there in the quarterfinals now, and they did prove that even on a bad day, they can eke out a victory, and which is good for any side.
I think that speaks to the development of that side. They have found ways to win games when they are under the pump. And I think that's a wonderful quality. I mean, they won the inaugural event. So, I mean, they are a champion team. And some of those qualities were again on display last weekend. Even obviously after about 48 minutes, they were a player down, player sent off. They were still able to rally and keep the Lions at bay and manage the game well. I think that's the other thing they did very well. As for the Lions, I mean, if I was a Lions supporter, I'd be very disappointed. Not so much in the performance, the on-field performance, but the way they set out their stall and the way they went about, given the circumstances of not just the game, but in the wider context of maybe sneaking into the Champions Cup or getting into the top eight and securing a place for the playoff. They opted to go the, let's build a bit of innings and maybe get some scoreboard pressure by kicking penalties. Whereas they, I thought, should have been greater urgency in trying to get a try-scoring bonus point in that game. And as it proved, that's what made the difference ultimately, because if they were able to get a try-scoring bonus point, they would be in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, I think the take back, I'm not sure what minute it was, but I'm sure you probably remember the incident. There was one attack where the ball went out wide. Ed Wolf and Amava got the ball chipped, and he and there was a whole series of things where he didn't chip. He broke on the far side touchline. Sasha Mgumzulu ankle tapped him. Brock Harris made a falling back tackle, which was quite unbelievable. But then in the series of play, Sasha got up again and tackled Frankie Horn over the sideline. And they got a penalty for that move. And I felt that was the sort of time where we've seen Lions teams on the front foot where if they had to go again, they would have probably scored a try there. And if they scored a try there, I think that we would have seen that Lions, you know, surge, that sort of 1-2 knockouts of the tries that they can do. And I just felt the fact that they decided to turn around there and pointed to the posts and said, no, we're going to take the 3 points, just sort of said everything to me about the way they were approaching that game. And I think that was a missed opportunity. I was, it's hard to say one incident, but that just sort of signified the way they were approaching the game.
Yeah, it wasn't just that one incident. I think the idea was just to try and win the game and get into the top eight. I don't think, given the way they played, they had aspirations of playing in the Champions Cup, because they would have needed a full house. I think that if they reflected on that game, that they will know that they were very much in that contest and that they had the Stormers at one point. And by playing the way they did, by tactically going about their business the way they did, they basically kept the Stormers in the hunt. And it doesn't take much for the Stormers to score a try from turnover possession or to be under the cosh and then suddenly turn things around and put 7 or 10 points on the opposition very quickly. The Lions, the kind of side that has to build a bit of pressure before they ultimately grind their way over. They are potent from broken play as well, but I just felt in that game they had enough going for them to be a bit more ambitious.
Yeah, and I think that was lacking. Just a last word from me on the Stormers. I think three players stood out for me. Ruben van Heerden, as he has the entire season, has been almost the rock, made the most tackles. Really has come into his own in that Stormers side. Ben Jason Dixon, who it surprises me every week he plays, extremely physical, and you can see why he was invited to the Springbok alignment camp, although there's a lot of competition in loose forwards. And then the interesting thing was Evan Riss, the last couple of weeks playing six. Now, I don't quite see him as a jack though, but it's not like he's been playing badly in that position. I just think he's probably one of those players where if you're John Dobson, you want him on the field somewhere. It doesn't really matter where. Yeah.
I think for the way they play, having that mix, having him on the field and Achiba Daimani as well, that suits the way they play. Playing him at six, I think, does bring another dimension to that position. But you wouldn't necessarily think of him as an out-and-out six. But having those three players operate in concert is potentially a nightmare for the opposition. I mean, if the Stormers have a few things going for them. I think he's come on in leaps and bounds, actually. I think the only thing, if you have to be hypercritical of Ruiz, is the composure element. You know, in those moments in the game where you need cool, calm heads, whether that part of his game has progressed as well. But I mean, he's a fine player, and probably he has the inside lane for the Bok 8 jersey.
Well, yeah, there's certainly going to be a debate over the next couple of weeks. Who will take that one? I mean, Jasper Visser is out. Dwayne Vermeulen is out. So we're going to probably need two players. And it's interesting to see if the box go for an out-and-out eight or the versatile sort of guy. But he's certainly shown his versatility. Cameron Honeycomb is another who will have and Elric Lowe. Well, they'll definitely stake a claim there. But I suppose it all depends with how the Springboks want to play and what where they see that guy fitting into their game plan. Now, one guy we haven't mentioned, who I think is a bit of an outside chance, is Frankie Horn. Well, I was sort of bemused to see this weekend took the most lineouts of the round 18 of the competition. So, and is one of the top lineout jumpers at eight in the entire tournament, which is rather surprising. And he's been in good form as well. Certainly not a player that will let a team down anyway. But he could come into the so lots of questions. But talking about the Lions, let's talk about the Lions.
Yeah, certainly. I just wanted to add about Frankie Horne. He certainly is a dynamic player in that he gives you all those things, gives you the grind. He has the physique, and then he provides you that punch in the wider channels where he links up with his outside backs. Probably not the position where you would pop up routinely for the Springboks if you're wearing the number eight jersey, but it's a nice skill to have nonetheless.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about the Lions there. you've been waiting for this one. Okay, so
I thought we just did.
no, we're going to say so. Now the question is: it's another season. Last season, they changed all the assistant coaches. And they said that was the reason why they didn't get into the top eight. Now, we've had another season of inconsistency. And the question has to be asked, are they on the right track? For me, they've got a good young group of players. They've invested in a youth squad that they brought through from that won the under-21 championship. And have really sort of started maturing. The likes of Frankie Horn, Kuen Horn, Henko van Wijk, you can go through them, a bunch of them. They've added a couple of good players like Sanele Nwamba, Marius Lowe, guys who've really given them. And in their front row, the Smith brothers, and there's a good mix of youth and experience there.
Yeah.
They've got some good coaches. I mean, individually, if you have to look at every assistant coach, you would say Jacques Ferry is a good defense coach. He's been a defense coach everywhere else. Julian Rodden knows about the scrum. You can go through them one by one like that. But then the question becomes, what is going wrong for them? Because why can't they take that step up? Is it a lack of ambition? Is it maybe the wrong head coach? Is it the budget that they don't buy? Because I think even though they've got probably the smallest budget of every team in South Africa, in the URC, they bought quite cleverly, and some of the players they've bought have impressed me. Eric Cronier, for instance, came through at the end of the season very strongly. And, I mean, I wouldn't have thought he would have done as well as he did. So, for you, then, where did that go wrong for them? Throwing your curveball.
Look, they cut. I think ultimately it comes back to, and I used that word earlier as well in describing the way they went about their business in Cape Town. They just need a bit more ambition. And with that, obviously, comes, if you're going to have more ambition, obviously, it comes with what you're prepared to put in. And I think ultimately, their business plan is certainly not one that, in any shape or form, one that mirrors what happens at the Sharks or at the Bulls, for instance. They cut their cloth well, I have to say, in terms of their budget and what they spend and what they get out of their players. They've done well. But of course, if you want to be competing routinely as a top eight team, I'm not even talking now trying to get into the semifinals and the final of the URC, you are actually going to have to spend a little bit more. And it's not just money, but it's like you need to make proper investment in the development of coaches, the development of players. And I'm not sure if we've seen that from the Lions. So they would have to have a good, honest talk and get to a point where they decide whether, they are happy with plodding along, being a mid-table team, or do they have genuine aspirations of sitting at the top table and, fighting and competing for trophies?
Yeah, I think for me they starting to resemble almost like a Greek quiz in the Curry Cup. That team that's tough to play, they can eke out a upset here and there, but never are really going to challenge the big sides when the big players are back. And if you look at the Lions, if you want to compete, especially in the Champions Cup, you've got to, and that's the way the Bulls and the Sharks and probably the Stormers as well look at it. They look at how do we compete with a Toulouse, with a Leinster, with a La Rochelle, and what do we need to do to improve ourselves? I don't think that Lions are even in the same, I wouldn't say the same conversation, probably not in the same room, not same chat group.
I think league is what you're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, I think they'd be very happy to just, yeah, go through the motions in the Challenge Cup, and that's worrying.
I'm glad you used an example of another team earlier, because and I'm going to use a football example, Brendan. A team that comes from they've got a decent support base. They come from a big city. They've got some spending power, but kind of plod along. I mean, like a team like West Ham.
I was waiting comes for you to mention.
So sorry.
I was waiting for you to mention that. It's a good example, because West Ham are great, and everybody doesn't know I'm one of the few West Ham supporters in South Africa. Liam supports that other team in red, not the one that hasn't won a championship for quite a while. But the other one where things used to clop. Just on West Ham, I mean, it's precisely what you say. They have ambitions. But they don't have the same ambitions as a Man City or a Liverpool, etc. For them, it's about securing European qualification and then trying to do your best in whatever you do. And you buy within your limits. They don't, not like those bigger sides, go out and, you know, buy a big player. I mean, for instance, the perfect example is a Declan Rice, who's your one superstar that you had, and you've gone and sold him. And fair enough. I mean, I know these decisions are
a lot. But to be fair, if that's what your business plan is built on, then, you know, that's what you need to do. I think in the case of the Lions, there's often talk about the size of squads and what the salary cap should be. You never hear them complaining about we need to get a bigger cap. The cap should be moved up. They're quite happy to sort of operate within their means. So if the cap is 85 million, they're not necessarily going to spend 85 million. That's just what the ceiling is. So, you know, those are the, you know, conversations that they need to have and get to a point where they find it a different way forward. If they want to be more competitive.
Yeah. And you see, this is where, and now we're speaking also a bit in hypotheticals, but they've lost the Jordan Hendrickson. They've lost Emmanuel Chituka, they lost Willem Albertsen, who's retired as well. So they've lost a couple of players, and you look at who they're going to replace them with, and pretty much players from the Curry Cup or from Varsity Cup, and that takes a time to get those players. However, you know, every player who gets a chance or want to do his best and might have that hidden talent to come through, and that comes down to coaching. But it takes a while for those guys to get into the squad and show their worth. It's not every player will come in the first game and score four tries and be a superstar. There's a development process that takes place in that as well, and that comes down to coaching as well. That's why I come back to the coaching. Because if you're going to continue to lose your stars, and they've been lucky so far that they've managed to tie in the bulk of their junior group for years, but at some point somebody's going to come for Kewan Horn or Henko.
Exactly.
Because, yeah, and I'm not even talking in South Africa. The players also have ambitions of making Euros and setting up a retirement fund for themselves. So at some point, you know, one of the bigger teams will come and take those players, and the agents will be more than happy to move them. So, for various reasons, not just commission. But that leaves the point is where they're going from here. And I think that's the thing that we don't know, is that there's been marginal maybe improvement, but when your two best performances this entire season have been two games you played with 14 men, which have been astounding and really impressive victories with 14 men. But if that's the highlight of your season, you've got to have some conversations now going into the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, in the games the way things have gone well for them, they've been very impressive. But then they've struggled to back up good performances. I mean, they've been wildly inconsistent. If you just look at the raw numbers, if you look at the log, played one, lost. They do score a lot of points, especially at Ellis Park. We see this with the Bulls as well. On the high felt, you tend to rack up the points. So they've got a good points difference. But when it comes to game management and grind out wins, that's a skill or an ability that they haven't honed properly yet. And that only comes from, I suppose, if you have players that have been playing together long enough. And if you have players who have played at a higher level, who's used to operating and playing under extreme pressure, that will help you get over the line in some of those tighter matches. Because they are matches, clearly, that they could have won had they had more experience on the field.
Yeah, and just turning those, sort of, I just think after the game against Connacht, where they won 14 men, the game against Glasgow, where you hoped and expected them to maybe just press on, you know, and take that sort of momentum and that sort of excitement of those wins. And they completely almost fell flat. And then the Stormers game as well. I mean, it was, you know, that Glasgow win was sensational, the way it came about. And it just, they couldn't replicate that a week later. And you would think a good team would be able to take that momentum and build on it. And they haven't done that. But I suppose we have to talk about, there's a couple of quarterfinals coming up as well. Do you want to say one last thing about the Lions? Sorry, then.
Yeah, no, and I think let's park the Lions. I mean, I think they will have to have some conversations internally, and hopefully come back with renewed verve and vigor next season, or in the next URC.
Yeah, and I think hopefully we'll try and get in one or two of the decision makers onto this pod. We have been having some chats in the background, but we'll try and get somebody onto also answer those questions as well for us in the next couple of weeks as well, before the new season begins at least.
Yeah, absolutely.
But let's get into the quarterfinals. We've got four quarterfinals as normal. That's a let's start with the Bulls-Benetton one. An interesting clash, just from the point of, well, I mean, the Bulls should be favored at Loftus in any playoff game, especially at 3:30, even though it's a bit cold in Gauteng at the moment. 3:30 kickoff, it should favor them. The altitude should be in their favor. I'm saying the same thing twice, but Benetton are an intriguing bunch. They beat Edinburgh quite easily. And they certainly, while they didn't really trouble the Bulls, they scored 35 points at Loftus last time they were there. And coming back with nothing to lose, and in the context of the previous game, they'd just beaten the Sharks, so they could have almost seen their tour as a success already, no matter what happened at Loftus. They're now coming back with nothing to lose, and certainly it's an 80-minute game. Do the Bulls have to be wary?
I think they shouldn't be complacent. So if we were to say they shouldn't be wary, I mean, that basically boils onto the same thing. They can't be complacent. I mean, they might have won well in the league match at Loftus, but I think Benetton has shown enough elsewhere that they are a side that should be taken seriously. So I still expect the Bulls to win by a comfortable margin, but the way they go about the game will be important, not just in this game, but also if you look forward towards the semi-final. The urgency and intent that they show in this game, that's going to be key. You can't be passive. They need to, from the outset, assert their dominance, because Benetton will be a handful if you allow them to be.
Yeah, they're definitely a team that can drag you down. Well, maybe that's saying being a bit unfair to them, but they can get you into an arm wrestle if they want to. And if you allow that to happen, especially at Loftus. I think let's listen to Kanan Moody, who obviously we're all a bit worried that he was going to go off the field last week with an injury from a Springbok point of view. But he's fine, and he believes, and he might have heard you talk there, because he believes tempo is their biggest ally at Loftus.
Yeah, I think for any team, you know, in the playoffs, you wanna start well, you know, especially if you're playing in altitude, you know, you want teams to match your tempo, lift the tempo, but so that they can, you know, get easier tired and you know, slow the game down. But yeah, I think they will have obviously learned from the last game a few weeks ago that how they can slow the game down or make things a bit more controllable for them and where they could thrive in. I know they're obviously a very good team. You know, they have lots of Italian international players, you know, that bring cool heads to the team. You know, and you know, for us, you know, we don't take them up lightly. You know, we learned our first lesson. We played them in the Rainbow Cup, so we know they're never going to be an easy team. And we played them, I think, 2-3 weeks ago. So not that we know what to expect from them. You know, playoffs are always different. But like I said, yeah, they are a very good team. They have a lot of international players that, you know these kind of situations and know how to function under pressure. So and for them, they'll get a lot of confidence out of a good win last weekend and yeah, coming back to Loftus after, you know, not playing here so long ago. So I think they'll have a lot of confidence coming back here and it's playoff, so you know, lots on stake. No, I think like our mentality has been the whole tournament, you know, we obviously now we're not chasing tries, but you know, we always wanted to get a win. So I think we're gonna play. Coach is obviously going to choose the best team and choose the best team to get the win for us, you know, go this by this thing, you know, where we say what is needed. So I think the coaches will sit and decide what is needed for this weekend to make sure we get the win. But like they say, you know, nothing is achieved in ideal conditions, but, you know, we've created this scenario for ourselves. You know, we've worked hard all season. We've played well, you know, we put ourselves in second on the log, and now we have the opportunity to play home quarters and semi, and obviously that helps with the traveling as well. So I think we're getting a lot of confidence that we get to play hopefully in front of a packed Loftus crowd. You know, you get to sleep in your own bed, you know, follow your same routine. So I think that gives the guys a lot of comfort and confidence to try and play the best they can on the weekend.
I think it's going to be a tall order for Benetton. If you look at the way the Bulls have gone about their business at Loftus this year, I mean, I think they averaged something like 40 points per game at Loftus, and that's good going. Even if they don't get to 40 this weekend, I think they should still, because it's a knockout game, so I don't expect them to sort of let all the dogs off the leash. They should still win well.
Yeah, I think if the Bulls, yeah, I think you're right about the tempo game, and Kanan's right as well, is that they want to hit fast and they want to hit hard and they want to play at pace and use that, because obviously Benetton, even if they came over, I think they're probably traveling on Tuesday. They traveled on Tuesday. They're going to be wherever, even they sit in Durban for the weekend. We're not sure where they're sort of preparing, but the altitude is going to be a factor when you come over that late. And it's not like you've already been in South Africa already for a week. So that short notice, they need to use that altitude against the other team. And I think the Bulls get that start that they want. They pretty much, I think they settled in the way they want to play. And so if they get that, yeah, I see a good Bulls victory, but we could have a high scoring game again.
Yeah, I think, and you mentioned earlier, Benetton's got nothing to lose, so they will have a go. And it obviously that also means the Bulls will have to play with a bit more attacking purpose, I would imagine.
Yeah. The other South African team playing on Friday night, or was it Saturday night? Sorry, Saturday night. Stormers Glasgow. A tough task because Glasgow, although, I mean, I suppose you can't talk weather-wise because this time of year, you might actually see some sunshine in Scotland, and I think that'll buoy the Stormers. Probably be a bit warmer, maybe even than Cape Town at the moment. But
maybe they'll get the same weather. Maybe they'll get the same weather as they did when they played the Dragons a couple of weeks ago. Because I mean, that I was shocked when I tuned into that game because the sun was out. It looked like it was midday, and it didn't look like Wales. It was a splendid afternoon or early evening.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, the commentators, I think, mentioned it about 20 times and then came out wonderful the weather was. That tells you how, if they were gushing about it, it must have been one of the few days it is like that around there. Same in Glasgow. Glasgow can be a bit to be honest. But I think the Stormers will give themselves a shot. They've definitely got the game, even though their away record has been terrible in the URC. I think they do have the team.
In fact, on that point, and I was probably unfair to them on a program I was invited on a few days ago. Their terrible record, as we have now described it, that was only at the start of the competition. So they won their first two games before they traveled, before they went overseas, and they lost. In fact, I think they lost to Glasgow, they lost to Benetton, they lost to Munster, and I think they lost to Cardiff. And none of them were by huge margins, but the problem for them was it set them on the back foot for the rest of the campaign, and it was very difficult to catch up after that. The only away game, and when I say away game, I'm not talking about overseas even, I'm talking about away from Cape Town, that they've lost since was at Loftus. They lost to the Bulls. They conceded 40 points there. Bulls hit their average in that game. So their form since then, away from home, has been okay. I mean, they went on tour not too long ago. They won against the Dragons, and they won against Connacht. And while there were patches in both those games where they were a little lost, again, they found ways of getting back and winning those games. So I think as much as, you know, it kind of, you have that view of how they played earlier in the campaign that kind of sticks in the back of the mind. I think they might be encouraged by the way they've traveled the last while. And I think they might also be encouraged by the way Glasgow don't appear the force now that they were maybe a month ago. I mean, at some point they went to the top of the table and they looked, I'm not saying they're not, but they are a very organized side, but it just looked like they've in recent weeks not quite peaked, you know, played at the same levels.
Yeah, it's hard to say, I mean, how much that Lions loss hurt them, because it definitely hurt them. If you look at the way they played against Zebra Palmer, we both expected that one to be a huge victory. And in the end, they struggled to beat them. I think it was 36-25 or something at the end. But it wasn't the performance we expected from Glasgow. And I think the combination of touring when it's not the worst weather up north, plus the Stormers do have the game plan, as we've said, and you said before in this podcast, is they've got the game plan where they can score tries from nowhere, and they can, you know, sort of turn over ball and get that one try. And all you need in one of these games is a bit of hope, and a bit of hope can go a long way. And they certainly a side that will back themselves, and they've got the talent. Mm. It's still going to be a tough ask, because Glasgow will be favourites in the game.
I think it's a very difficult game for both teams. You use the word tough ask when you described in your intro to this game earlier for Glasgow. I think it's a tough ask for both teams. The Stormers have to travel, and that does take a little bit out of the legs. There's no doubt. Your preparations, you don't have a full week of preparation. And as for Glasgow, I mean, they certainly need to find their rhythm again, and to try and find that against the former champions, the team that played in last year's final, laden with Springboks, you know, tough ask there as well.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting game. Let's look at the other two semifinals. The one I must admit I'm quite looking forward to, the Leinster-Ulster game. Ulster, of course, had a magnificent victory 3 weeks ago against Leinster. But that was in Belfast. This is now at Aviva Stadium. Very different, although, yeah, they'll still give themselves a chance. And the way they played against Munster, and they didn't come out off in the end there, but they, you know, Munster had a bit of luck in that game, especially with Arche Snyman, who could have been red carded in that early on in the game, but he got away with it.
Easily have been red carded, yeah.
And I mean, look, that brings up other sort of discussions about consistency of red cards and all that sort of thing that we always talk about.
Let's leave that for now, Brendan. That's another series, let alone one episode.
Yeah, no. I know. And maybe at some point we should get the guys from Progressive Rugby on here, the guys who are fighting the head knocks, the thing, because I think it would be good to hear from them. But yeah, Munster did have a bit of luck in that game, but Ulster was certainly a handful for them. And I think they will be a handful for Leinster, although I'm sort of wondering how the desperation of Leinster not winning the Champions Cup is going to filter through. They took a week. Their second string team that they played against Connacht could have won probably by more. Connacht were nowhere in the game in that game. So, I think this is definitely going to be sort of fueled by hurt, and how much that is fueled by hurt is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, look, I think defeat for Leinster in this game, given the defeats in the Champions Cup, not just this year, but the last few years, would be too ghastly to contemplate. I mean, that would be questions will be asked of the coaching staff, I think, if that were to happen. So it's a very important game for them. I think they will go into that game. Not that they would otherwise, because it's a derby match and we know the rivalry there runs thick. But it's one that would have dire consequences for them. So I think they'll be completely and utterly fired up. And to be fair to Ulster, I thought they were good value last week because they were in the face of the, you know, of the defending champions. They played with pluck. They played with a bit of desire, made things very uncomfortable. And in fact, for the bulk of that game, it looked like, you know, the potential upset was on the cards. Didn't quite work out. But I think I would expect them to play with the same urgency against Leinster as well. So not an easy game for Leinster, I don't think. But I think ultimately they'll pull this one through.
Yeah, and I think just let's hear a little bit of audio from Dan Sheehan, one of their star players, and just how much that hurt is feeling them and how they see the game going into the game. But yeah, I think same. I think Leinster, it's going to be an interesting game to watch. But if I had to put money on it, I'd probably say Leinster should come away with a good 10-point victory there, although they'll have some moments which they will be a bit scared about the outcome. So let's listen to Dan Sheehan quickly and we'll talk about the other quarters.
Yeah, it's obviously something since I've come into the group over the last few years. I haven't won a trophy with this group, and it's definitely been something we talk about at the start of every year is trophies, and it's a major part of this club, and the history of this club is winning trophies. So we talk about it all the time, and I think it's important too. So we don't get ahead of ourselves. We have to win on Saturday to put ourselves in a position to go into a semi and win that, and then we'll move on from there. But you know, it is an important week for the club, and in the Aviva against Ulster is a good way to start. Ultimately, it's going to be the hardest game you play all season. Finals, it's always going to be a different feel to it. We review each game and there's always probably different areas. One thing that probably comes back is it's always who can master the basics the best. I think you can fall into a trap of maybe trying to do too much or having a plan that's too intricate, and then you forget about the small basics of just game plan, territory, breakdown, and the carries and tackles. So that's definitely one thing. But I don't think it's a mindset thing. I think everyone's intent you see in those games is right at the top of the game. It's tough when you're playing a team that obviously has a plan to disrupt you, and if that plan comes up and works, they'll probably do well. So I don't think there's anything like that's been one specific team over the last couple of years, but you know, we've definitely taken our lessons from each of those games individually, and hoping to put them into practice now when we come into these knockout games.
The final quarter, which is Munster, who obviously with that win they got to the top spot, denied the Bulls the top spot, which I think we were all hoping for, and they faced the team that ousted the Lions in the last game, the Ospreys. Now, I've got to say from the outset, the Ospreys have had a tough year. Toby Booth, great coach, always good to engage with him. Yeah. But they've had budget cuts, and for what they've done with their budget cuts and all the issues they've had in Welsh rugby has been quite astounding to come through and win that game and get into the eighth spot there. But Munster at home is maybe a bridge too far.
Mm. Yeah, you've got to admire the Ospreys. They've been... They've in some ways punched above their weight. They've been feisty. They've been in the faces of the opposition. Don't go away easily. They'll need all those qualities this weekend, though, and they'll need them by the bucket load because Munster is again on a roll. I mean, it's fairly ominous, especially when you consider what they did last season. So it's going to be it's a monumental task for the Ospreys. I think this is the one quarterfinal where we can save fairly safely that, you know, the home team should rumble home by a few points.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see the Ospreys fight back, and I'd love to see them upset Munster, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's probably going to be a very comfortable victory for Graham Rowntree's side. Saying that, interesting weekend ahead. There's also Franco Smith's obviously coaching Glasgow, done well. I just want to mention Johan van Graan, who ironically with Franco was Alistair Coetzee's assistant coaches. Johan van Graan's taken Bath to their first premiership final ever. And if you consider Bath were almost on the verge of being relegated until they took the relegation away last season. What he's done there at Bath since moving from Munster has been quite astounding in the last sort of season and a half. So good luck to them this weekend and in the Premiership final. Obviously,
it's good to see Bath do well because they're one of those sort of traditional English clubs. Good support base, great venue, obviously, Rick. And you, it's just one of those teams that you want to see, you know, doing well from afar. So I'm very glad for Van Gran. He's obviously done a sterling job. They're turning things around.
Yeah, and I think we should get him on. Hopefully they'll win. We'll get him on the pod at some point to chat about it and what how he's changed things there at Bath. I mean, just another South African coach who maybe should mention because he's somebody we haven't forgotten about. Johan Akerman, this Japanese team, were formed two seasons ago, and he has taken them to the first division within a year, which has been quite good. So we hope also, and he's expressed the desire to come back to South African rugby. So hopefully we'll see Akers back in South African rugby sooner rather than later.
I wonder where he would fit in best, Brendan, if he would come back.
That's a good question. There's an obvious one. He has coached before, but whether there would be that sort of ambition there is what still needs to be answered. So we'll leave that one there. Just I think as we go out to the show, as we start wrapping up, some good news. We often talk about wins and losses, but we had Martin Anaye, the CEO of URC, on a call yesterday, and he was chatting about just the phenomenal growth in the URC and how from year one to year three, that has just exploded in terms of broadcast figures and just way beyond the expectations and just how good South African teams have been in the URC. So before we listen to him, Liam, I mean, it's quite nice to hear, first of all, because we all hope there is a long-term future in Europe for South African teams, despite those people who are naysayers. I mean, there's one very prominent columnist who believes URC would be dead in 3 years, and now we are in year three, and it seems like it's growing faster than they expected.
Well, yeah, not the conclusion necessarily, but after every URC campaign, and there's now, you know, third year, the folks who run the competition, they gush about the growth of it, whether it's attendance figures at the ground, whether it's people tuning in, watching, whether it's social media engagement, there's no doubt that the competition has set new standards and set new marks. If you compare it to, say, pro rugby, the competition that was in place before the URC. So, I mean, obviously they are ecstatic, and there's no question that the South African dynamic has contributed hugely to those numbers. So long may it continue.
Yeah, I think the challenge becomes once you grow like that is the expectation is that you're going to carry on growing. So that's the challenge. And obviously the other part of that is Europe. In the Champions Cup and the Challenge Cup, we've now got a team that's won the Challenge Cup. But how long before South African franchises become competitive? When I say competitive, I mean how long before they challenge in the playoffs of the Champions Cup? That's going to be
interesting. I think, though, that is almost a separate argument. I think the URC can prepare you well, but then there's also, I suppose, within your own realm that you can do more to try and be more competitive in a Champions Cup. Because I think, I mean, the competition itself is, it prepares you. I think it prepares you well for the rigors of Champions Cup. Because if you look at the teams that routinely do well in the Champions Cup, I mean, a number of them campaign in the URC. So, you know, I think it's as a stepping stone, it's a great competition.
I think that this also comes with experience, but just handing those big games. I mean, we used to have them in Super Rugby when, say, the Crusaders used to come or, you know, in a knockout round. But handing these bigger teams, especially when you get used to playing the same teams in the competition, and that's what South African teams haven't had in the past. You play everyone in Super Rugby, you play them in the playoff, and that's where it ends. But the contrasting styles of English and especially French rugby, and the contrasting styles between the teams in French rugby, that you don't play week in and week out, and suddenly you're faced with a massive game against the Toulouse or La Rochelle, who are totally different than what you expect and have a player budget that's double anything in the URC. Those are the type of challenges you've got to navigate. But that comes with time, and that's going to challenge coaches, and we've seen it already challenge some coaches, and there's been a lot of debate around that. But I think as it continues, we'll get a lot smarter. Teams are getting a lot more ambitious in terms of the way they're signing players. So long may the URC continue. Long may it grow like it has. And I think we'll leave it there. I think we'll go out with listening to Martin and let him gush a bit about the figures. But we'll chat again next week, Liam.
We certainly will. And long live the URC.
Never thought we'd be saying that in the end of a show. But anyway, okay, have a listen to Martin. We'll chat next week. See you then.
Yeah, that's right. I think we are most proud of that, genuinely, to see all of our we haven't had it in URC 1 or 2, so to have it in the third season of URC, I think shows that structurally the competition is sound. We've got teams competing all the way through. And show sort of jeopardy right through the league. You know, we had a very, very tight run in, as you know, I mean, almost to the last try of the last game. And to get Ospreys through as that Welsh qualifier in, and Benetton in there from Italy, that's really, really pleasing. That's, you know, that shows that I think we've got a strong league, not just at the top end, but into the middle and into the deeper reaches of the league, which is, yeah, as you say, really, really pleasing and something we're most proud of here. Yeah, so we're tracking up across all those metrics, and it's something that we keep a really keen eye on, and we break it down by territory and then across the board. And we really focus on audience growth, because I think if someone like myself and the team that we have here at URC can focus on that's on social media, whether that's on broadcast, and then ultimately bums on seats. And we're really working super hard with our clubs to do that. Those are the key metrics to show growth, but also a healthy competition. And I think we have that. You know, broadcast is up 49% globally. In the UK and Ireland, it's up 24%. Attendances are up 67% on last year's record cumulative audience going into the final round. Socials are up. You know, our social media numbers are now really doing very well. I think in the last charts on YouTube views, we're the fourth globally of rugby content producers. That includes NRL. So, you know, competitions around the world, which we look at, and think are doing a great job. We're up in that sort of group of leagues and competitions. That's really pleasing. I think it just shows there's more eyeballs on the URC, and if there's more eyeballs on the URC, by the very nature of that, there's more eyeballs on our clubs, and that helps them to become sustainable in their own right and successful. And that's why we keep track of those metrics. Our database, something that sort of is a good barometer for how many people are engaging with the competition, more in depth, because we have lots of detail on those particular fans. You know, that's up 116% from when we started URC. So I hope that shows that we've sort of got something here that's growing. It's getting more awareness. And ultimately, that's bringing more fans into the game, which is what rugby needs. So last year, we had a record, I think it was 34.9 million cumulative audience. We're already through that, with round 18 hasn't been counted in that. So we'll surpass last year's record on cumulative audience. But what we're seeing is there's growth right across, not just in South Africa. There's growth globally. We're on Sky Italy for the first time in a very long time, and that's going really well for us in Italy with Benetton's success. That helps, obviously. So we keep track of all that to make sure that, you know, we're pushing the right direction. Our clubs are very keen for us to increase attendance, and that's very important for us to help them. And we've launched an initiative called Collaboration Labs or Collabs, and that's for us to help our clubs drive attendance into each of the grounds. And so we've got a team internally supporting our clubs on a daily basis, and that feels a lot more collaborative, literally, than we've ever had before. And I think we're seeing the results now.
Thanks for listening. And a reminder, you can find all the To The Last Drop podcasts on the Brendan Nell YouTube channel, iono.fm, Spotify, player.fm, Pocket Casts, Google Podcasts, and iTunes, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.